It's The Wonky Show. Today we're discussing the graduate route and changes that might be on the horizon, what to do about rising pension costs, and there's a new tool that lets us understand how graduates do or don't move around the country. It's all coming up.
And for me, it's, you know, there's a worrying thing if international students start to feel that they're being treated like a kind of cash cow and not being looked after once they get here, then, you know, then that just makes the whole situation even worse.
Welcome to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm Wonky's editor-in-chief, Mark Each, and joining me on a reverse brain drain from the week in higher education are three fantastic guests as always. In the Cotswolds, it's Mary Connor Cook, chair of the Dyson Institute in Pearson, UK. Mary, your heart of the week, please.
I've actually got a proper highlight. I went to see Midsummer Night's Dream at Stratford on Tuesday, and honestly, it was absolutely fantastic, uproarious, uplifting, just brilliant choreography, and yeah, I loved it. Totally joyous.
Lovely. And in Newington Green, it's Omar Khan, Chief Executive of TESO. Omar, your highlight of the week, please.
I don't have a highlight nearly as interesting as Mary's. I suppose my highlight has been I've been having some good quality time with my son, who's 11 years old, who's, I think, finally settling into secondary school, which is obviously a good thing.
And in Oxford, it's Michael Salmon, Wonky's News Editor. Michael, highlight of the week, please.
Just finally and somewhat belatedly booked my summer holidays. We're going camping in Catalonia in July, so something to look forward to.
Excellent. Right, Michael, walk us through what's going on over the graduate route.
Yeah, so last week the Home Office finally got round to writing to the Migration Advisory Committee saying we want this review of the graduate route, which they first said they were going to do back in December. And the thing that caught everybody's attention and raised a bit of alarm was that the government wants this committee to report by May. So this committee is independent from the Home Office. It's a sort of advisory body and it's made up of academics. They've been quite skeptical about the graduate route in the past. And they were also not very impressed to be given such a short time to do it in. I think it took the government almost 100 days to write to them with the proper commission, and they've only been given just over 2 months to do the review. So yeah, people around the sector started thinking, okay, there's a sort of political reason here why the government wants a review so that it can then maybe have a policy recommendation, a manifesto promise. And this week, former Universities Minister Joe Johnson was speaking at an event, and he said that, you know, from what he's aware, Rishi Sunak definitely does want a policy announcement on post-study work rights around for international students. You know, this might not be the sort of nuclear option that we had about 10 years ago, where the whole graduate route equivalent back then was scrapped. Yeah, it might be something a little bit more sort of, you know, pragmatic around sort of some element of sponsorship, or, you know, requiring individuals to have a certain amount of money in the same way that international students need to for study at the moment. You know, so it might be more tinkering, but it's certainly going to be something that people are worried about, given the all the other restrictions and just policy churn around international students we've had in the last 18 months. You know, so sort of policy commitments aside, there's a lot of worry around the sector about just the perception that it gives to students, because it has the potential to be one of these changes that affects students who are applying now, or even who are already here studying now, even though we don't know what it is. So it's sort of more uncertainty around the future international recruitment.
Yeah. Right. Mary, this is I guess what they call unhelpful in the sector, isn't it? I mean, it's bad timing, given already the changes made to graduate route has seen people being put off from applying to the UK to study this year, and we're seeing the long tail of effects of that already, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think they were saying that the January intake was 40% down after the dependence announcement. I think what gets me about this is that it's a real sort of clash of policy and politics, you know, just getting entwined, and a feeling that the policies around this are being kind of coordinated and choreographed around immigration and visa announcements, clearly for political reasons. And of course, this is just so worrying for the sector, because universities across the spectrum are relying on international students to increase the sort of average unit of resource across the whole student population, with domestic fees frozen. And I think, interestingly, you know, it's kind of going to create a real gulf between the kind of top end and the lower ranking universities, because it's much easier for higher tariff and Russell Group universities, who not only attract the most international students, but they also charge most. And it's the lower tariff universities who really have to work harder to attract international students. And they take more, I think, from countries impacted by the dependence restrictions recently. And of course, they charge less, you know, so this is just yet another potential financial blow to that end of the sector. And we'll come on to talk about pensions, which I think is, you know, is just another thing piling up. And yeah, so I think it's incredibly worrying. I did think that the Max letter was pretty pointed, saying they had less time to do the work than it had taken government to commission it. And then they also demanded some quite sensitive HMRC data from the government, you know, by next week. I thought there was a bit of sort of touche going on there.
Omar, could you sort of put yourself in Rishi Sunak's shoes just for a second? Can we try and unpick why this is happening? If we take it as a kind of good faith policy kind of direction of travel, rather than, you know, just politics as you know, which is another option, can you kind of explain why the government wants to do this?
Sure. I mean, I'm not sure I'm in Rishi Sunak's shoes saying this. I don't know what he's thinking, but it's clear enough that there are limited levers for government to manage immigration policy. And obviously, the proportion or the number of students within the overall net migration figures is relatively high. And so, I mean, Rishi Sunak isn't the first prime minister to spot that. Obviously, when Theresa May was prime minister, there was also concern around the number of students. And you know, obviously, there's been some discussions about taking students out of the net migration figures. I think it is difficult, though, not to point to the political considerations here. And I think it is a difficult area for higher education. The reality is very few voters go into the ballot box deciding on, you know, the government's policy on higher education, but quite a number of voters might go into the ballot box deciding on their migration policy. And so, you know, there are concerns, wider concerns about the migration numbers. Obviously, there's also concerns about whether or not all of the graduates who get this route are either doing the kinds of graduate jobs that, you know, that would justify the graduate visa route. And I think there's even obviously concerns about, which I think are overblown, although, you know, the MAC will hopefully flush this out, whether or not some of the courses, especially one-year master's courses, are in fact supporting the labor market in Britain, because obviously those are the other policy areas. I think that's one of the tricky things here. There's multiple policies, policy objectives that are in play here. There's the policy objective around higher education numbers and in particular income for higher education institutions. There's migration policy. There's also labor market skills shortages. We know that there are skills shortages in the labor market, and some of these graduates are filling those gaps in the labor market. And finally, there's even concerns around things like integration and Britain's sort of global cultural and economic heft. You know, attracting these kinds of students can be good for our society, not just economically, but in terms of our cultural contributions and global reputation. So, but the reality is the driver here seems more to be migration policy and public opinion, and that's not a new thing. Rishi Sunak is far from the first prime minister. And of course, speaking of the politics, it's likely that this is also something that's going to be quite pointed for the next prime minister, whoever that might be.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, if you think back a few years, when we talked about immigration and international students, there was a sort of feeling generally that international students were a good thing, and the debate was whether they should be taken out of the immigration numbers altogether. What I think is really worrying now is that the sort of government quote, you know, that they put out whenever anything comes up in the Sunday Times or wherever is, you know, we want to make sure this is about education, not immigration. And so this kind of new specter of international students potentially using the graduate route as a sort of backdoor to, you know, to come to this country potentially forever. And yeah, I just think it's getting a bit ugly. You know, all the things that Omar was saying, you know, of why international students are potentially good and needed in the economy seem to be completely pushed out of this debate, which I think is really, really worrying.
Yeah. And I guess, Michael, are there reasons to be optimistic? Because, you know, on the one hand, it looks fairly clear that Labour is going to promise to continue to reduce net migration. But I guess is there hope that around the edges of that, students aren't going to get caught in the crossfire as much?
Well, certainly Labour is, you know, they value international students. discursively, right? You know, whenever they're being debated and there's policy changes, Labour, you know, they want to position themselves both on the side of, you know, universities and HE more generally, and on international students, and come across as more sympathetic. You know, but policy-wise, it's kind of hard to see, you know, all these various small changes affecting international students and also, you know, skilled worker thresholds, which are just about to go up. You know, Labour has said it will, you know, it supports them. It's either voted for them or said it won't undo them around dependence. You know, so I'm not sure on this issue I'd feel hugely optimistic that Labour wouldn't, you know, it's, if the Conservatives just announced something in May or June, that Labour wouldn't just sort of more or less go along with it. You know, it depends what it is. If it was some big nuclear thing, but I just feel like Labour is showing no appetite to have any kind of, you know, policy differentiation around migration, you know, apart from this issue of Rwanda, which is, you know, just entirely different. But in, as you say, in terms of the headline net migration, net legal migration things, my sense is that there's, you know, in the run up to the election, there isn't this desire for Labour to have this as a dividing line between them and the Tories. You know, if the review had dragged on to sort of the back end of 2024 and probably after the election, which is, I think, what people assumed or hoped would happen when it was first announced, then that would be a different issue. But yeah, it is, in some ways, that will be the most interesting thing to look out for when the review does report, and when it, you know, is next being discussed in Parliament, is what, you know, do Labour have the sort of appetite to put their money where their mouth is on things like international students and support for the HE sector in policy terms?
Yeah, I pick up, as you all know, TASO focuses on access and participation, and principally that means UK undergraduate students. Obviously, as Mary has indicated, you know, the international students are a key part of sort of supplementing higher education's income at the moment. And I think there are genuine concerns that this wouldn't just have an effect on international recruitment, but on the ability of universities to expand their access and participation. So, I mean, to the extent that both the current government and a Labour government would be wanting to see a rise in the proportion of free school meal students, for example, going to university, you know, and to the extent that the current funding regime doesn't, you know, is inadequate for universities to expand their domestic market, thinking about this in terms of a market, there's real concerns that anything that cuts against the current income of universities or increases the costs of universities, which we're going to talk about in terms of pensions, that, you know, it does pose a challenge for their role as engines of social mobility.
I mean, and this is the thing that is so widely misunderstood, isn't it, Omar? Because, you know, the Sunday Times series of articles, you know, if you read that, you know, a layperson might assume that, you know, one international student takes the place of a domestic student. But it's a much more complicated picture than that, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my understanding, I'm not an expert on master's courses in particular, but that, yes, it doesn't, you know, the levels of income that universities are the levels of tuition fees that international students are paying. And I think there's not full understanding of how much some international students are paying, well over £20,000 a year, sometimes £30,000 a year, and I believe even more for these master's courses. You know, that is, in fact, helping to fill what is otherwise a financial hole in a lot of universities' budgets at the moment.
One bright light on the horizon, I think, is the fact that Steve Smith is going to be involved in the MAC review. And, I think he's not only incredibly knowledgeable about this whole area, but I think he's trusted by both government and the sector. So I think that's a good thing that he's involved in this.
Medium term, then, Michael, I'm sort of concerned that the UK is kind of going to decline as a destination for international students for one reason or another. Either universities become so defunded that facilities, quality of experience, etc., declines, or the government makes it so difficult, unfriendly for international students to come here that people just don't bother, particularly when other markets are kind of going in the opposite direction. Or some combination, some nightmare combination of the two. I mean, should we be planning just for a smaller sector at this point? I just can't get my head around, like, where this is meant to kind of budge.
I think, you know, for us watching policy, and just for the sector as a whole, it's these sort of, you know, quarterly or termly intakes that are very, very important, because, you know, they're what brings financial stability. So if the January intake does prove to have been a 40% drop in recruitment compared to the January intake last last year, which is obviously a smaller intake, you know, that all eyes on September, right? I mean, you know, that seems like a massive story. You know, I think for the government and also, you know, for this, for the committee and for people who are sort of trying to see the UK, this awfully fractured, chaotic sort of series of immigration changes there have been, you know, for people trying to see it like that, it's much more of a, you know, a 5-year window. So international recruitment is so far up on what it was in 2019, for example, and the pandemic and the dips and the sort of, you know, uncertainty there is also complicates trying to see it as a sort of as a long-term trend, because it sort of distorted the data so much. You know, so there's certainly a risk there's going to be a snap back, but the question is, you know, isn't the sector still going to be bigger in terms of the international students it's recruited than, you know, it really had a couple of years of just enormous expansion in that, in a way that, you know, to just say, oh, you know, a 5% drop or a 10% drop is a catastrophe, is, I think, you know, for policymakers and for people who are just looking at what the net migration figures are, it's quite hard for them to really get on board with that, especially when, you know, the students who were recruited 2 years ago will probably be in the UK for quite a long time, right? They'll be on the graduate route. They'll then be trying to get onto a skilled worker visa. You know, they could be here for a long time. And so in some ways, the sector sort of, you know, cashed that check already. But for those who are just interested in net migration levels, it's a long time before it looks like, you know, that it's okay for them to go up again.
I mean, I'm as guilty as anyone in talking about international students purely in financial terms as well. I think, you know, Michael shows there, and I think it's a wider concern that international students aren't part of sort of wider policy objectives around things, even like student mental health, for example. And I think it is important to remember that these are individuals, these are students who've come a long way from home often and, you know, do need support. And I think it is a bit unfortunate that sometimes, I mean, even my organization, which focuses on access and participation, you know, we don't extend our remit to international students, and they face some of the same challenges of domestic students as well. And I think it's important to remember that sort of human element here as well.
That's so important, Omar, because Secret Life of Students last week, which was a fantastic show, by the way, Mark, event rather than show, it was really clear that some of the things that domestic students are suffering, for example, having to work a lot, you know, in order to be able to eat and have accommodation and so on while at uni, to the detriment of their studies, those are the same privations experienced by a lot of international students. And I think we forget that. And for me, it's, you know, there's a worrying thing if international students start to feel that they're being treated like a kind of cash cow and not being looked after once they get here, then, you know, then that just makes the whole situation even worse.
Right. Let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
I'm Libby Homer, Director of Student and Library Services at Anglia Ruskin University and co-chair of Sconnel. This week I have written an article about the critical review of transitional agreements published by JISC in the last couple of weeks. According to the review, it will take the big four publishers 70 years to transition to fully open access if they continue to transition at their current rate. And to add to that gloom, whilst the UK has led globally in open access, author behaviour has not changed, with 90% of research still being published in the top 10 journals. Have a read of the article and see what you can do to shift the cultural dial.
Okay, there's been lots of discussion of pensions this week. Omar, walk us through it, please.
So Universities UK and the Universities and Colleges Employers Association, or UCEA, have written to the government this week asking for a review of post-92 institutions' mandatory participation in the Teachers' Pension Scheme, also known as TPS. And this is because there's an imminent rise in costs. While the government has offered some financial support for schools and FE colleges to meet those rising costs, that offer of financial support has not been extended to universities. So what does that mean? So from April 1st in England and Wales, employer contributions, so the amount of contributions that universities will have to make to the TPS, will increase from 23.7 to 28.7 or 5%. And there are similar increases in Scotland and Northern Ireland for equivalent schemes. The letter that was written to the government notes an ever more challenging financial environment facing the sector, and we talked about this in the previous item, drops international recruitment, getting a particular mention. a consultation of members found that almost half, or 46%, of post-92s have made redundancies since last August, and some are now said to be facing an existential crisis. And of course, we've heard this, you know, more generally, that a lot of providers, a lot of higher education institutions, particularly post-92s, are facing financial challenges. So this doesn't look like good news in a difficult environment.
Yeah, no, not at all. Right, Mary, can you explain to me why universities have to be, or post-92 universities have to be part of a TPS? Or what is going on here?
This is a sort of battle, isn't it, of university autonomy against what seemed to be the kind of handcuffs that were part of the post-92 settlement. And incidentally, I thought it was a really cool move from UUK and UCL, rather than just asking for more money to support it, asking for the ability to exit from the pension handcuffs, you know, and playing the university. You know, you say we're autonomous institutions, therefore we don't help. Well, give us the autonomy to choose how we manage pensions for our staff. And I thought that was a really good positioning from the sector. I mean, it is huge. We know pensions are a big issue, not just TPS, but also the local government pension scheme and indeed USS in the past. But for these post-92 universities, the pension contributions before this new increase are already 13% of staff costs. You know, so it's a huge, huge burden. And I think Vivian Stern at UUK and Raj at UCL, I think they're although the letter is about specifically about the TPS, they're also kind of folding in a local government pension scheme, which I don't know the specifics of that, but it's all in the same territory. And they're just saying that post-92 institutions must have greater control over the pension schemes they provide their staff. So I think it's a really interesting move. I think so far the unions have, you know, kind of muttered rather than kind of instantly calling for strikes about such a move. But anyway, we'll see. But it, you know, as Omar said, this is just yet another financial burden for an already financially fragile sector, and particularly this bit of the sector.
Michael, is there a sense of what would replace TPS if universities were allowed not to take part in it?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it could be that some of the more, you know, it's odd that we have this system where, you know, half of the sector more or less has to be in this scheme, and then the other half is sort of, you know, as people said, kind of has institutional autonomy. I mean, they are all in USS, but for their professional services staff, you know, there's all kinds of different arrangements in different parts of the pre-92 part of the sector, whereas for the post-92s, all of their non-TPS staff need to be on the local government pension scheme, which, you know, there was mutterings about 5 years ago about whether they would be allowed to exit it, and they've asked for that to be sort of revisited too. I mean, you know, it could be that some of the sort of more upwardly mobile institutions might think, you know, well, okay, USS seems to have ironed out some of its issues. But I think more generally, it would be, you know, looking at replacing it with private pension schemes that require much smaller employer contributions. We've seen the odd institution try to do this through employing academics through sort of a private subsidiary company. And, you know, that's been very heavily contested. At least one institution sort of gave up on doing that, I know. I don't know. I'm not sure whether they've thought that far ahead, or it's just really that they are throwing the dice for a way to get costs down. I think there's probably a sense in this that this is one of the few things where the Conservatives might be slightly better disposed to it than a future Labour government would be. I can't quite see Labour doing this in the same way. But, you know, really the big question I ask myself is, you know, from the government point of view, is there any benefit to the Treasury in allowing big universities to opt out of these pension schemes? I would have thought not, right? Like, I mean...
Yeah, presumably other members of the scheme wouldn't want universities to leave either, because for all sorts of reasons.
Well, it is TPS and LGPS do operate differently, because they're not like USS, where you've got to have an asset base to support future liabilities when people retire. They're kind of government self-funded schemes, you know, that they're just, you know, there isn't a bulk of money invested in stuff for these schemes. So it is a bit different. And Michael, I just wanted to slightly take issue with the idea that, you know, USS is a kind of an autonomous choice for universities, because it's very much kind of Hotel California. You know, you can check in, but you can never leave. And I think here what the, you know, pretty much every other business sector in the economy has moved from defined benefit to defined contribution schemes. And I would imagine that that's kind of the shift that some in the university would envisage making, albeit that that would fundamentally change the kind of, you know, the sort of social contract with staff in the sector. It would be a very big move. But, you know, these pension costs are just, you know, quite out of kilter for, you know, any other sector in the UK economy.
It's really hard to know what to do about it, isn't it? Because, you know, as both Michael and Mary have explained, it is, the alternatives are potentially extremely unpalatable to, you know, staff members of these schemes. And yet with rising costs, you know, that puts universities in the, you know, almost impossible position.
Yeah, it's not a recipe for good management employee relations, is it? I suppose it is also worth flagging that I think there is a lot of dissatisfaction amongst academic and non-academic staff about not just pensions, but sort of their conditions. And I suppose this is an environment in which, you know, trying to make more dramatic changes, for example, moving to a defined contribution scheme, I agree that is more standard across the sector, but it would obviously be quite a lightning rod at the moment. I think the other thing that's, even for myself, I can't claim to be any expert on pensions. It is curious, the differences, right, across these different institutions. I mean, it's another example where we talk about the higher education sector. But, you know, there are very different ways in which people are remunerated. You know, these pensions schemes are different. If you move from one university to another, how do you, you know, port over your pension? If you move from one kind of contract to another, all of this, I think, is another aspect of this that's sort of one of the reasons why academics are quite defensive about their pensions. And I don't think it's always transparent, you know, for those working in these higher education institutions, what it means. There's also, I think, if we were to move to a defined contribution scheme, there might be then pressures, or at least a focus on the relative pay of academics in the UK relative to other countries. And, you know, because it's the overall package of benefits that obviously attracts some people to higher education. And there's a view, whether or not it's the right view, that academics accept lower salaries than they could get in the market otherwise, whether that's the domestic market or the international market. I don't, you know, whether or not people would actually move with their feet. And one of the things that is keeping them in the sector, despite sort of dissatisfaction and arguably less market pay, is the relatively generous nature of their pensions compared to other bits of the labor market and other sectors in the economy.
Now, it's been a red letter week for the wonks, as a great new tool for the ONS has let us find out exactly what happens in English towns and cities when it comes to graduates and universities. Mary, tell us what's going on here.
Yeah, well, it's been tagged as being about a brain drain, which we normally think of as, you know, kind of losing great intellects to international markets. But this topic has arisen because there's a devilish new tool from the ONS, which sets out to map where people live when they do their GCSE, so assuming that's kind of home, how many get degrees or sub-degree qualifications, level 3 to level 5, and then whether they leave home to get them, and then whether and where they move next when they go into work. I thought, I mean, you know, this is a fantastic tool, and I thought the key points were not all that surprising, but it's nice to have the evidence and the data. So big variations in the proportion of graduates by region, we know that. Large minorities, probably around a third in most places, of graduates living somewhere other than where they did their GCSEs. And then, again, a thing that I think we know intuitively, that graduates are more geographically mobile than non-graduate qualified people, and especially if they come from rural areas and small towns rather than large towns or cities. And then I thought it was interesting that the brain drain is less of a thing than it's supposed, mostly because it mostly happens because there are so few graduates who move into low graduate population areas rather than because lots of graduates move out of those low graduate population areas.
Brilliant. Thanks, Mary. There's an awful lot here, isn't there, Omar? I mean, the, you know, what does this say to us about the state of the economy versus the state of what higher education institutions can actually achieve? Fascinating about that inward mobility point. But also, you know, does it point to a kind of a wider lack of educational opportunities?
Yeah, as a self-described and proud data wonk. I was really pleased to see this. I mean, obviously, the data is really impressive, but also the visualizations. And obviously, we do these visualizations to try to make the data better understood. But as you indicate, there's still a question of interpretation. Now, no matter how flashy or you know, colorful the chart. And I think here the question is, you know, are these areas places that there aren't enough graduates so that we need to boost the proportion of graduates? Or are these regions that don't have a local economy that can adequately support a higher proportion of graduates? And so then from a policy response, do we need to boost the proportion of graduates in an area? Or do we need to try to ensure that, you know, there are more graduate jobs across a wider range of localities and regions in the UK? And obviously, I was also really struck by this point that people aren't so much leaving areas as that certain areas aren't attractive to or aren't attracting people from outside of those regions. And that was something that I don't think was as sort of explicit before. So this is some, I think, a new thought. I think one of the things that we're obviously concerned around at Tezo is that we know that the inequalities of access to higher education are not just that vary quite significantly regionally. And obviously, these data are picking up some of that, right? So that in certain localities, it's not just that you have a higher proportion of people going to university, but a higher proportion of those on free school meals. And obviously, one of the solutions there is not merely to improve higher participation rates of more disadvantaged learners, but those are also some of the areas that have the poorest GCSE outcomes and sort of speak to the wider educational inequalities that feed into the sort of inequalities in the economy that we see later in life.
Yeah, I think, you know, this, I think part of the reason these sort of tools and data sets become popular among sort of policy people is because it's really nice to think about higher education in these terms. And it's probably something we should be encouraging, right? That, you know, thinking about how HE benefits a local area, how it feeds into, you know, both labor markets, but also place and leveling up and how it sort of extends opportunities. You know, I mean, say you take Shrewsbury, for example, I mean, which I just had a quick look at, which because it's been in the news recently, it looks like it's in danger of losing its higher education provision. It has a university college, part of the University of Chester. I mean, I would add also that if you look on the ONS tool, it says it doesn't have a university. But, you know, that's because there's issues here about really looking at sort of the smaller and the kind of, you know, articulation agreements. But, you know, there's no one in local government in Shrewsbury at the moment, or, you know, or on the Shrewsbury High Street saying, you know, bloody woke University College Shrewsbury, good riddance. Why don't all these students do an apprenticeship or get a job? You know, people there will understand these students are doing apprenticeships through a university college, or they are working. They are, you know, they're, you know, and from the other point of view, no one in Salford is going to be saying, you know, why are we the area in England that's most inundated with graduates? You know, why don't they all go to Oldham instead? You know, so when, if we can kind of articulate this thing about, you know, it's not just about sort of GDP, and it's not just about, you know, how many billion pounds of contribution students make to the economy as a whole, but actually think about sort of, you know, towns and places, you know, I think that is nice. The kind of thing, and Omar said before, you know, and Mary has too, the more you play with this data, the other thing that you just increasingly start thinking is, it's not just about inflows and outflows, right? It is just, there's so many places where, you know, the differences in HE participation and high level skills are just so stark. You know, the mobility is interesting, but just these cold spots in education are really concerning.
Yeah. I was thinking about that while you were talking, Mary. I mean, we've talked about cold spots a lot, as you know, in kind of policy terms, and it's because it's a much more straightforward way of looking at, you know, map the UK, you can see where there isn't kind of higher education provision. I guess what's interesting about this is it speaks more to how, you know, the economy actually works, because you can build a university, can't you, somewhere, but that isn't necessarily going to have the kind of the economic impact that you might need. Or the answer may not be a university. The answer may be some other kind of partnership or skills provision, mightn't it?
Yeah, I think, it's very interesting, isn't it? And, you know, one of the things you are reminded about from these data is how many people go to a relatively local higher education provider if they participate in higher education. So I think there is a case for making sure that there is more provision in these cold or, you know, certainly slightly chilled spots around the country, just to make higher education accessible. And particularly, you know, we were talking before about students having to work and the maintenance grant not covering their costs and so on. So having local provision, I think, is becoming more and more important. And then the other thing these data remind you is how having a university in an area does in itself create positive economic activity and employment, and also attract, inward investment. So the other thing that occurred to me with this is that we've got a general election coming up, haven't we? And I would have thought that every MP, everyone standing to be an MP in an area would want to access these data and use that in their campaigning, because it's either about not enough people getting the opportunities to participate in higher education, or it's about people having to move somewhere to do that and not moving back, or it's about there not being enough economic activity and jobs in an area to attract graduates or keep graduates. So there's a kind of a whole lot of stuff there that I think is important for political campaigning. So hopefully this will be a useful tool for them. I thought it was a pity, by the way, that at some stage it'd be nice to have it all cross-referenced by socio-demographic variables, so we can see more clearly the impact that background and ethnicity and so on have for social and geographic mobility.
I mean, one reason we might want to see more university provision in cold spots is we know from the data that more disadvantaged learners are less likely to travel far to go to university. So the data show that those students that are most likely to travel, say, 100 miles or further, are most likely to be from the most advantaged backgrounds. And that clearly that it suggests that there's distance travel might be a barrier to access higher education. So insofar as we see cold spots in areas, one driver might be the fact that there aren't universities nearby. And picking up something that I think Michael said, I was in Halifax not so recently, but I do recall having these conversations with people in the local authority there. And they did say to me that Halifax is the largest town in the country without a university. And they weren't saying that as a badge of pride. They were saying that as a badge of the fact that it was part of explaining why there were that sort of region was sometimes seen as left behind. So, that one indicator or measure of being an area that's left behind is not merely that there hasn't been investment in the economy, but there are fewer higher education or other educational institutions.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to dig a bit deeper into anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget, you can get the latest show automatically when it's out. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And to find out about how we can keep you and where you work ahead of everything that's going on in UKHE, do head to the site and click subscriptions. So thanks very much to Mary, Omar and Michael. We're off for 2 weeks now. We're back after Easter. Jim will be here. Until then, stay wonky.